Okay. I'm on. How about that? Hi. That's the distribution I promised to have up. Total points as of yesterday. Yesterday. And the average, class average at the moment is 77. Let's see, there was another. Oh, on assignment 5, the average score on that was 15-ish, in that ballpark. And some of you are concerned about not having done it. If you look at the average for the class on assignment 5, and include the scores of those people who didn't do it, then it's about 8.5. Okay, so if you think about how much that particular exercise moved the distribution, there's an average of 8.5, less than 9 points. So that should make some of you who didn't do it feel a little less panicked at this point. Okay. I don't want to know. Okay. Right. Thank you. They were well socialized. They clean up their own messes. This is good. Okay. Assignment 6. Due today. And I have a stack, and you can add to that stack if you would like. I wanted to get a little feedback about doing it. What was it like, Vanessa? Very rough. Okay, so it was difficult to synthesize the whole bunch of Bronfenbrenner and boil it down to 5. Okay. Other thoughts about that particular exercise? I had several emails that suggested it was not as easy as you thought it was going to be when you started. So I feel vindicated. It wasn't supposed to be easy. Any other thoughts about the process of doing it? Okay, for those of you who did it, did you learn anything doing it? Was it useful? Only if you got points. Okay. Okay. I'll ask that question in smaller groups for those of you who are shy. If you have thoughts about the exercise, Julie or Greg or I, all of us would like your thoughts about what it was like to do it and whether you learned anything from doing it. And we'll be curious and we'll publish the best. Right? We'll make a fortune. Do we have any other housekeeping things? We will schedule a review session for after class, a week from Wednesday, which is our last class of the semester. So we will do that in here. Would you see? It's time for Julie to learn to schedule rooms. Would you also like a review session on Thursday? Okay? The day after the last class. Okay. Do you prefer that be in the The fact that I ask you does not mean that it's possible, so that I recall that there's some problem on my calendar for that afternoon. Would you prefer it in the morning on Thursday? Early afternoon. How many of you would like it in the early afternoon? Late afternoon? Evening? Okay. Sometime in the afternoon, after they're awake. Okay. And the exam is at noon on the first day of exam. No, skip that. The exam is at 4 on the first day of exams, a week from Friday, less than 2 weeks from now. That's really scary. That means we have to make up an exam. Okay. So if you have questions you think would be good for the exam, give them to Julie or email them. We'll take all contributions. Okay. No other housekeeping? Okay. Assignment 5 and a couple of other random things are down here on the table if you haven't gotten yours yet. We will get assignment 6 graded before the last class. So that will happen. Wave of panic from the front row. So we will get it done and back before the last class or at the last class. Okay? We were talking about the interdependence stage in Galinsky's presentation, and I had, I believe, talked about the fact that puberty changes the child. So as kids go into adolescence, a number of things change about them, and those changes drive the parent-child relationship, as has happened in each of the other stages. And that, of course, is a general principle. Anytime you have an ecological transition, a change in role, which comes along with developmental change, or a change in setting, for any member of the family, the whole system is going to be trying to adapt to that and create a comfortable microsystem again, and also adapt to the changes in everybody's mesosystems that come along whenever you have a developmental change. So that's a kind of general paradigm that we've been pursuing. And this one is a biggie. It's a big change for parents because of the changes that are taking place, both in the child becoming an adolescent and in that child now becoming adolescent's mesosystem. Because as kids get into adolescence, their mesosystems tend to change fairly dramatically. And we'll just run through some of those changes that happen. The physical and cognitive changes that take place at the beginning of adolescence change the parent-child relationship. They change the balance of power. They increase, potentially, the reciprocity between adolescents and their parents because they are now speaking the same language, using the same logic. So it's possible for them to share experiences and thoughts, critiques of the world, analyses, their emotional responses to things, more as equals than has been the case before. As kids get well into adolescence, they are having experiences that they have not had before, and they have their emotional reactions to those, and they take their new intellectual skills into those experiences and potentially bring them back home. And I hinted on Wednesday that one of the problems that parents run into is that they're unwilling to acknowledge the cognitive development of the child. But one of the difficulties that parents create for themselves is that they don't appreciate the kids' new analytic skills, especially as some kids like to apply those skills in critiquing the parents. And that's difficult for some parents, particularly when the kid is winning the arguments. That's particularly difficult for some parents. And rather than acknowledge the increasing reciprocity, the increasing balance of power, that is, the power is becoming increasingly more equal between them, rather than accepting that and celebrating it and saying, oh good, now we can get the kid out of the house and on our own pretty quickly, which we should celebrate, instead, parents begin to resist and try to hang on to the power that they have had. So the difficulty that parents create is that they're not encouraging the intellectual skills. They're not celebrating the change in power. They're not using, taking advantage of, and enjoying the increasing reciprocity that the kid is capable of. So some parents try to hang on to their power, and you've all probably experienced in some way, either your own or other parents, denigrating their children, not taking them seriously as they become adolescents, trying to one-up them, trying to maintain their power, and often resisting the reciprocity. So many kids find as they go into adolescence that their parents actually value them less instead of accepting them and valuing them more. So some parents, instead of taking their kids seriously and sharing the kinds of understanding that they have and the skills that they have with them, create a kind of joking, rejecting relationship with the child, when the child, becoming an adolescent, wants to be taken seriously and wants to take the parents seriously. So kids ask important questions, and parents unwilling to tackle those questions for whatever reason, and there are a lot of reasons why they might be resisting tackling those questions, that parent rejects the question or rejects the questioner or denies the kid's the seriousness of the kid's interest and inquiry, gives you a joke back. Okay. The kids are asking questions that the 9-year-old or the 10-year-old in the interpretive stage have not asked. Okay. Kids, as they get up to be 13 or 14, want to know if their parents smoked pot when they were in school. Okay. Parents may not want to answer that question. Kids may want to know, now that they're going through puberty, when is it okay for me to have sex? How will I know when I'm in love? Why do you and Mom have such a terrible relationship? They ask those questions. Why do you fight all the time? They ask those questions that younger kids tend not to ask, and teenagers ask them seriously because they're really interested in what's going on around them in a different way. And parents who aren't sure of what the answers might be, or what is appropriate to tell a child, can say, well, I'm not sure, we'll talk about that, let me think about it, I'll go read a couple of books, and then I'll talk to you about it. And that's okay, because it says, it's a serious question, I take it seriously, I need to do my homework before we have a discussion. That's one approach. But the other approach that you often see is, don't ask. I'm not going to talk about that with you. Why would you ask a stupid question like that? So the kid is, again, as sometimes happens in the interpretive stage, put down when the question is serious. What the parent has the potential to do is to create a grown-up-to-grown-up relationship with appropriate limits on it. You don't want to tell your kids everything about what's going on in your life. There's some things that should not probably be shared. There's some things that parents have a right not to tell their kids, but they should be straightforward about that. In my role as parent and your role as teenager, I'm not ready to talk about my first sexual experience with you. We could talk about yours, which hasn't happened yet, And we can talk about sexual experiences generally. And we can talk about when you think you would be ready. We can talk about what your peers are doing that might be inappropriate or dangerous. We can talk about what you know and what you think, and I'll take your ideas seriously, and I'll give you my serious consideration of them so we can have a conversation that is much more reciprocal than conversations we might have had in the past. When Galinsky uses the word interdependent, what she's referring to is the increase in equality between parent and child, the more equal power intellectually and otherwise, and the potential that parents have of learning from their teenagers about serious things. All adults have the potential to learn from their kids, but what you can learn from teenagers becomes different because they are understanding the world differently than children do, and they're experiencing a world that children don't experience. And particularly in a society such as ours that has changed so rapidly over the last half century, kids are often exposed to things that parents had no experience with, didn't have to wrestle with, and don't really have much competence at. That makes it possible, as kids are experiencing things that parents don't experience, haven't experienced, it's possible for parents to learn about the world that their kids, as teenagers, are encountering. But that requires that you be able to say, it's okay for me to learn from my child. It's okay for my kid to know things that I don't know. I don't have to be the one in charge. And that means that we both can learn from each other, and we have the possibility in adolescence of creating a relationship in which people share the knowledge and experience they have openly. The parent is able to say, in some cases, I want to learn everything you're learning. I want you to teach me. I can ask you to explain things to me that I don't understand. I can ask you to tell me what's really special about rap music. Or tell me who these people are. Why do you admire this particular singer? And I'll tell you about, well, now we're getting grandparent generation. I almost said Pat Boone, but you don't even know who he was. Whatever I was listening to or not listening to when I was a teenager. What was I listening to? Elvis Presley. First Elvis Presley records. I had them. Wish I still had them. We discovered. I saw the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. The first time, not the rerun. I saw it. And I can talk to my kids about why we thought they were so incredibly good and entertaining. Couldn't talk to my parents about it because they sort of didn't share that view that they were possibly entertaining or good. My parents were open-minded, but not that open-minded that they would deal with rock and roll. Okay, so parents have the possibility, and they are in the process of negotiating, either actively or passively, and negotiating, getting along in the microsystem with somebody who is powerful, attractive, potentially sexual, involved in activities that the parent is not involved in and won't be involved in, learning things that the parent is having a great deal of difficulty learning. And parents decide openly and directly or implicitly how they're going to relate to that new person in their midst. They're creating a relationship to the new mesosystem settings that kids are involved in. Kids are involved in different kinds of dyads, and parents are, to some extent, gatekeepers about how that dyad is going to go. It's not perhaps surprising that one of the things that kids encounter, particularly females, in our culture, is that parents become more restrictive, not less, more restrictive, as their daughters go through puberty. The things that they have allowed daughters to do, they begin to pull back. And the double standard for freedom for males and females in many families emerges. They've done a pretty good job of treating boys and girls equally, but as they go through puberty and the family begins to wrestle with reproductive potential and sexuality, the double standard that many families have implicit in their value system, that double standard emerges. And one of the complaints that daughters often have is that their parents are clamping down on them at the same time they're letting their brothers go do whatever they want to do. And parents have no illusions about why they're doing that. They believe that puberty has made their daughters more vulnerable, that it's a world that does not treat reproductive age females, particularly young ones, does not treat them kindly in many cases, that there are dangers out there. Guys were the dangers, if you hadn't noticed. So that double standard comes into the microsystem, and the parents are then faced with treating daughters and sons often differently because of the reproductive consequences for them. Kids are getting into settings that have less parental and other adult involvement. As kids are able to take the car, drive away, they're creating settings that they didn't have before. They're going to settings that they weren't able to go to before, in which the parents are much less evident and adults are much less evident and in charge. So the microsystems in those settings are made up of teenagers doing whatever it is they do together when the adult roles are not represented in those microsystems. So parents all know that. The part of what they have to do is create their attitude and govern the mesosystem connections that their kids have. Where can your kids go? Who can they go with? Do parents have to be present? Do adults have to be present? How do you enforce that? How do you reduce the ease of transition to a new mesosystem as a parent? How do you talk to your child about the relationships between your goals for them at home and the goals that may be represented for them in another setting? How do you help your kids as they're beginning to find jobs where there may be other adults present, but they may be bosses, and they may or may not have the kids' best interests at heart? How do you talk to your kids about how you're going to how they're going to manage that mesosystem? As they add work to school and home and other activities that they may be involved in, how do you help them avoid conflict between the mesosystems that they're now involved in? And it's very clear from the literature on adolescence that kids who work up to 15 hours a week may benefit from that. Kids who work more than 20 hours a week do not benefit from that. And kids who work full-time clearly reduce their academic performance and decrease, although they're earning money, it's very interesting. Kids who work full-time during high school, and there are a large number of kids who do that, those kids are reducing their lifetime earnings. They got it during adolescence, but they are reducing the potential for earnings the rest of their lives. Because they are reducing the probability they will go to college, they're reducing the probability they will finish college, and they're typically not building resumes that are going to get them into jobs that are going to pay well. Full-time work for most adolescents doesn't have much future, unless being an assistant manager at Wendy's is the future that you want. It requires education. And the kids who are working full-time are hurting their academic performance in high schools and then their potential academic performance beyond that. Okay, so that's an important meso-system connection, and parents know that, or they don't deal with it at all, depending on how they're dealing with their adolescents. Kids are into problems that parents don't understand very well. That's a problem in dealing with adolescents, because kids are often dealing with things that parents have not dealt with well themselves and can't really guide the child on, the adolescent, because they've not had the experience themselves. They may not understand it. And kids are also getting into problems that parents share. And that makes it difficult for parents sometimes to advise kids on what they ought to be doing. A kid comes to you with a problem that you not only don't really understand, but in fact characterizes your own life and your own behavior, you may not be the best person for the kid to come to. If it's a problem you've been through as a parent, it's a problem that you've been through and solved or resolved, then you may be a very good source. But one of the issues for parents is who to send their children to get good advice about dealing with issues. You know, some of you would probably not approach your parents for advice on how to resolve problems in romantic relationships. Some of your parents haven't done that very well themselves. Okay, a couple of major issues, Galinsky says. Communication. How do you communicate with this person who's using the same logic? And how do you set limits and give guidance? How do you help the adolescent negotiate the various settings that he or she is in and the relationships among them? When you're dealing with an 8-year-old, you can direct the kid into particular settings. You just take them by the top of the head and point them where you want them to go. You can take them. They can't resist. You're much bigger than they are. How do you get your adolescent to engage in settings and activities and relationships that you may think are good? Because adolescents are often in places where there aren't adults, and because the adults that are in their settings are often not choosing, or in their mesosystems are not choosing their settings for them, parents often have much less opportunity to have interactions and dyadic relationships with the adults who do know what their kids are doing. So managing the mesosystem by being there, by being a part of it, by communicating, by all those indirect links that make a mesosystem richer, doing that may become more difficult for the parent. Galinsky talks about avoiding power struggles when there are, in fact, many, many opportunities for power struggles with adolescents. I'm not going to go into that greatly. I was just struck by one of the statements that she made, which is that when teenagers and parents have conflict about money, it's always about power. It's always about power. I don't think she had read Bronfenbrenner when she wrote that, but it makes sense within the context of power and affect and reciprocity within the relationship. when parents are having that conflict over money. Some of the issues that get into the microsystem. There's a cruel irony, Galinsky says, that is substantiated in other work looking at parents of teenagers. There's a cruel irony that the younger in the dyad are just heading toward the peak of attractiveness according to the media in our society. Their attractiveness to peers, their potential, the wonderfully exciting, heady years of dating and picking a mate, and there are the parents stuck with old what's-his-name that they chose in the same process many years ago and now are dissatisfied with. And there's the older generation going downhill rapidly in many families, losing whatever attractiveness they might have had, losing their potential sexuality, at least finding it more difficult to find partners, and in a relationship which may not be nearly as exciting as the new relationship that the 16, 17, or 18-year-old comes home bubbling about. And the parent is sitting there listening to the kid bubble about how many people hit on her at the mall. And mom is thinking, it's been a while since anybody hit on me at the mall. And the only one who did was drunk and probably psychotic. And there's some natural envy there, which some parents manage pretty well and other parents can't disguise. Some of you probably have seen couples and seen families where as the kid gets more and more attractive in 17 and 18 and has the boyfriends around, mom begins to take a left turn someplace and decides it's time for her to shape up and lose some weight and change her hair, and change her makeup. And one of the places that you see her trying to demonstrate some sexuality is flirting with the daughter's boyfriends. Some of you have had that happen, probably. And it's funny if you're not connected. It's sad if you are. It's frustrating and infuriating if you're in the middle of it. And it's just very sad in some cases. But what you see is the parent who is responding to the kid's burgeoning attractiveness and sexuality and popularity and the cluster of boyfriends who are flying around. You see the parent who's trying to join in, who's trying to be part of that group, usually not very effectively. Dealing with the sexuality, the problem within the microsystem. And it has very simple manifestations. What happens is the kid going through puberty, male or female, wants more privacy. So the kid is spending more time in the bathroom and wants the doors closed and nobody can come in. And 3 or 4 years before, it didn't make any difference. So you could share the bathroom. People were brushing their teeth while you were peeing, and it didn't matter, and in some families. But now it begins to matter. And when a family has been fairly open and unself-conscious about bodily functions and bodies in general, it's particularly noticeable when the kid begins to get self-conscious and want the privacy. And that can be a source of conflict. Parents have the responsibility as kids go through puberty to recognize what's happening and back off. Kids don't want to be hugged. Little boys don't want to be swooped up by moms and given a bear hug, particularly not in public. And it's important for parents to recognize that self-consciousness and back off. Temporarily. They do want a big bear hug a couple of years later or 3 years later. And what happens, unfortunately, in some families is that the kids give the don't touch signals. You know, I'm uncomfortable if you hug me, Dad. They give those signals off because they're temporarily self-conscious. So affection becomes less clearly demonstrable and less welcome. And it's important for parents to recognize that that only lasts 2 or 3 years. And then you can go back to being affectionate, and people really do like to have hugs, and it's okay to be demonstrative again. So there's hope for parents whose kids are going through puberty and are self-conscious, that they'll become less self-conscious. They'll put it in place later. They'll still want the bathroom door closed, and they'll still spend far too long in the bathroom. But they really do want parents to be affectionate with them, appropriately affectionate. Kids are dating. That's a big source of conflict for parents and teenagers. And the fun parts of dating are when the kid starts bringing new romantic partners into the household. And they do that. Some of you manage to date a lot without your parents ever meeting the people you were dating, I'll bet. Some of you didn't. But some of you manage to keep that part of your life very separate from your parents. And parents feel that. They know when kids are doing things that they wish they could know more about. They just worry about it. But they don't. In many families, the new romantic partners don't become part of the microsystem. In others, you bring those people into your microsystem. So you got a new boyfriend, you bring him over for Saturday night dinner. He comes to family events with you. And parents have to figure out how to incorporate that person who clearly has nefarious designs on your daughter. There's some sexuality in the air when people are romantically inclined. You have to deal with that in the microsystem. How do you deal with that? And the teenagers are dealing with it themselves. How affectionate can you be with your new girlfriend when she's meeting your parents for the first time? Can you play footsie under the table? Is that all right? Can you hold hands while you watch television? Can she sit on your lap? Can you spend an hour in your bedroom making out with the door closed? Can you borrow your father's condom? Now, what are the rules here? What are the limits? I know, you don't borrow condoms. I know that. Okay. But if you've forgotten your own, is it okay to ask your parents? Dad, got any condoms? Mom, can I have 3 or 4 condoms? My girlfriend's spending the night. Is that okay? In some families it's okay, in some families it's clearly not okay, and you know what's okay, and you know how much to discuss with your parents. And one of my favorite ones was, actually my son was a bit older, and we had already worked out some of that stuff. I put condoms in my kids' stockings at Christmas when they were dating. They gave them to their friends, I'm sure. But they thought it was pretty cool to have a parent who would give them condoms. But when my son was dating one particular young woman and involved fairly, my mother came to visit. And unbeknownst to me, the girlfriend had spent the night. But it was all right at that point. But Grandma didn't know about this. And one of those times when you wish you had the videotape, When she came down the stairs, I wish I could say in the morning. It might have been late morning, but anyway, they came down together. And my mother was trying to figure out, since she had been up since 6 or so, before anybody else was up, how had this young woman gotten into the house? She thought maybe it was while she was getting dressed, and so we let it go with that. But she knew the young woman had been there in the evening. She just didn't figure that out. So the microsystem was trying to wrestle with what the roles are, what the changes are, what are the relationships, how do you deal with that in the microsystem, and at what point do you meet your daughter's boyfriend's parents if you don't know them? Your kids meet each other at school. They meet each other at work. They meet each other all kinds of places, and you may or may not know the parents. So you've got to figure out where you fit in their mess with system. At what point do you invite your daughter's boyfriend's parents to dinner? It's a challenge. Some people do, some people don't. I'll give you a piece of advice. I've learned a few things over the years. And one of the things that I've learned is that we always had an open house. Anybody was pretty much welcome to come in. We had kids who lived with us for periods of time because they weren't getting along with usually step-parents. And they were just always welcome. My habit through my kids' childhood and adolescence and continues now is that I feed anybody who's there. And chocolate chip cookies are always welcome. And they can eat them faster than I can bake them. But one of the things I hit upon when my daughter was just a freshman in high school was that when she had some new guy flying around, I like the metaphor of insect. No, I'm not going to pursue that one. Anyway, one of the things I encouraged her to do was to invite the guys for dinner. And this turned out just one of my, the guy's hanging around in the afternoon, so he's going to stay for dinner. And one of the things I discovered that this is actually an excellent time to observe the boyfriend and decide how much you want to discourage the relationship, whether you want to threaten him or not, to leave your daughter alone. But I discovered along the way that when she was intrigued by and interested in somebody who might, in my view, not have been appropriate, putting them at the dinner table and watching, inviting, encouraging them to engage in conversation with her family and letting her watch how he did that was a very useful piece of information, not only for the parents for whom I originally designed it, I want to know who this kid is, but it's very interesting for her to put that kid in that very familiar environment and see how he handled himself. And I can remember one particular young man that I probably would not have approved of, but at school he seemed to be fascinating and he had some interesting toys and he seemed to be intrigued. But after one evening at the dinner table with us, my impression was he's pretty inarticulate. He doesn't listen. He's really kind of crude, and nobody ever taught him to use a knife and fork. So, can we work with this? Is this material we can shape up? That evening was sufficient to cool her interest in him entirely, without any coaching on my part. Just did it. And since then, I've had dozens of occasions with both my kids and with my stepdaughters to watch the boyfriends at dinner and the girlfriends with my son. And just see how they fit into that microsystem. How do they handle themselves coming into a strange microsystem, particularly a microsystem that includes the potential partner or the current partner? How do they deal with grandparents? That's a fun one. Yeah. Can they fit in that microsystem? It's a very important piece of information for the potential partners to have about each other. Do they fit in each other's microsystems? And I suspect that we could probably turn that into a short book of guidance for parents about how to bring your partners, your kids' partners, into the microsystem so your kid can really see whether or not these people are going to be comfortable, whether they can relate, not just to them, but to their families in ways that are going to have sticking power. The interdependent stage is also testing the parental relationship. The parental relationship tends to be stressed when you're the first ones to go to bed. And one of the typical experiences that Galinsky describes is that couples who find that their sex life goes to hell in a handbasket because they're self-conscious about the fact that some people are still awake in the house. And they may not be. As comfortably uninhibited as they were when their children were asleep by the time they got it on. Identity is an issue for the kids, of course, in adolescence. And that connects to Galinsky's theme of images. The adolescent is playing with images of him or herself and pulling those images together into a sense of identity, a view of him or herself that is not created by the parents, that is not modified by the parents, that in fact in adolescence is distinct from the images that the parents might have. That's one of the tasks of adolescence, to create an idea of yourself, an image of yourself, not just out of your experiences at home, but your experiences in those other settings in your mesosystem, and particularly the ones that your parents don't share. Creating an identity that brings together all of the relationships that you have and makes sense out of those, makes them consistent. And the identities that kids try on during adolescence and the identities that they actually end up adopting for themselves may be very different from what the parents would have chosen. So part of the task for parents as their kids go through adolescence is accepting the image that the child has of himself or herself. Not just the parent's image that now has to be adjusted, but it has to be adjusted according to how the adolescent views him or herself. And kids are challenging the parental view of the world as they're out there in the world. They're finding out whether their parents have valid views of the system that they live in. As kids are creating their own, it may be different. So kids begin to see the world differently than their parents did, and that's an important part of adolescence. And they sometimes are not very polite when they point out how absurdly out of date and out of touch their parents are. But that's one of the privileges of adolescence, is to recognize that your parents don't share your worldview. And often kids have an investment in making sure that their parents know that they don't share their view. And parents have to either throw the kid out on an ear or accept that the parents' view of the world is different. And then we get ready to get rid of them, especially after all that conflict. We want to get rid of them, so we enter the departure stage, the last in Galinsky. The major task of the departure stage, she says, is taking stock of the whole experience of parenthood. As you're getting your kid ready to leave, and you get to reflect, how has this gone? How have we done as parents? And some parents discover that they haven't done a very good job, so they decide they want to teach you everything they know. The month before high school graduation, or the summer between high school and college, they've got to teach you all these things that they forgot to teach you as you were growing up. That's just a burden, but if you're the one who's departing, you can accept it as parental behavior, and now you can leave that behind. It gives you more reason to get out of the house. You're ready to go someplace else because your parents are trying to teach you everything they know. The related tasks for the parents are preparing for the departure, helping a kid get to college, helping a kid deal with the military recruiters, helping the kid figure out how to be at home after high school, working. When do you start paying rent? When do you have to cover your own car expenses? All of those things that acknowledge that the kid is leaving home, at least psychologically. What are the limits? How long can you stay at home after high school? I remember one very tragic kid. Town will be unnamed, but I was doing a workshop in a school and the teachers were talking about some of the families that they had to deal with. And this was in March, late March. And they were concerned about one high school senior who was about to turn 18 at the beginning of April. And her parents had told her that the day she turned 18, they were no longer responsible for her, that she had to find someplace else to live. She was on her own. And the teachers were trying to figure out, they believed the parents were serious, and they were trying to figure out what their response should be, and they were also wondering if there was some law. There is not. That requires parents to be responsible until their kids graduate from high school. There is not. 18 is the limit in Vermont, period. Parents have no further responsibility for their kids, and in fact can throw them out of the house. And I checked in with the principal a couple of weeks later, and the girl came home from school on her 18th birthday, and the suitcase was packed and waiting for her on the porch. And they refused to allow her in the house. So, fortunately, the school had picked up the slack and they had found another place for her to live. You kind of wonder, and I didn't get into it, but you kind of wonder what kind of conflict there had been in the household that had led parents to make that decision that they would not tolerate her presence. I'd like to believe they were just idiots and nasty and all that. But, you know, she might have been a really difficult kid that I might not have wanted at home either, but I'm not sure I would have done that. You've got to move out the day you turn 18. So, parents prepare for that in some ways. Some parents resist it. Some parents want their kids to go to local colleges, stay at home, live with them, let me take care of you, says mom, until you get married. And we'll walk you down the aisle and give you to some guy to take care of you or give you to some woman to cook for you. Otherwise, we don't trust that you can take care of yourself in the real world. So parents prepare for that departure in different ways. Some make it gradual. Some provide a safety net. Some make sure that your room is always there for you when you want to come home. And then however it happens, they have to adjust their images, since most of us don't leave home in the way that our parents really expect us to. And so there's some image adjustment for the parents that has to take place. And then you get to redefine yourself when you get the last one launched. You get to redefine yourself as an adult parent without kids at home. And that means the microsystem has shrunk. The family mesosystem may have expanded tremendously. And you have to deal with that. How do you get people to come home? How do you go visit them? If finances are a problem, how do you make that happen? You may find that you're not seeing your children that you've lived with for 18 years, you're not seeing them very often. It may be a long time. It may be a long time for siblings. I was talking to a young woman not long ago, she's not all that young. She's younger than I am. She's a little younger than I am. She hasn't seen a brother in 13 years. So she's planning to see him this summer. And I think, and you have a sibling you haven't seen in 13 years? It seems like a long time. Maybe that's extreme, but there are a lot of people who don't see their siblings very often, and parents who don't see their children for 2 or 3 years at a time. Lots of telephone calls, but we often become very, very separate, and our mesosystems don't overlap. That microsystem that's now empty also has two parents who have to figure out their roles and their activities. They've lost many of their important motor activities, which were focused on kids. So the family has to figure out, the parents have to figure out how they're going to be with each other. They may be looking forward to it, and we've talked about that before, as they started making love in your bed, now that they've got you out of it. Or they've gotten rid of your bed and now there's a sewing room there, the one that mom always wanted, or the computer room, or something else that you get to sleep with if you ever come home. And some of them are doing the emptiness divorce because they look at each other and say, well, the only molar activity we've really shared over the last 5 or 6 years is kids, and they don't need us anymore, and I don't need you anymore. And there they go. And they measure out their accomplishments and their failures. I'm going to add to what Belinsky wrote. Here are some of my favorite topics. When we look at the ecosystem of the parents, here are some of the variations on the themes. One is that you expect kids to leave when they finish high school or when they get married or when they go to college, and sometimes they leave much earlier than that. Some kids really do leave home and go to boarding school and never really come back. So they're out at 14, and they never really inhabit the parents' home again. I had a buddy in college who had gone to boarding school, not a private boarding school, when he was 7, and had never really lived with his parents ever again. Very interesting guy. He's one of the people who got me interested in ecology, in human ecology, because I was aware, even in college, what he had missed by not living in a family. And he was fairly aware of it too, but also by going to all-male boarding schools from the time he was 7 until he was 18, he'd missed a few things about male-female relationships, and they showed up in his sometimes sad and sometimes very, very funny attempts to have a girlfriend. He eventually got there. His third wife shaped him up, and he jokes about the fact that the only reason that he has a wonderful, wonderful third marriage, he's very happy, is that he finally got smart and married a child psychologist. And she took him on as a project and made him a wonderful human being. He was a wonderful human before. He just didn't know anything about relationships. I'd love to do a case study on him someday. He had departed or been thrown out of the parental home lovingly into the arms of the headmasters very early. Others hang around for a long time. And often kids are hanging around longer than they ought to because they can't get their act together, or they can't get enough money up for rent, or they don't have any goals, or they don't know what to do, and you watch parents pull their hair out because they can't get rid of this kid who's not doing anything particularly useful. If you become my friend, you become a case too. I have another college buddy who's trying to get his son out of the house. Not trying very hard. He sort of defines the concept of enabling, and he's been enabling his son, who is currently 33, maybe almost 34, about the same age as my son. He's been enabling him to stay at home, being unproductive and smoking a lot of pot for the last since he was 18. And Dad sits around and complains. And every once in a while, one of us gets annoyed with his complaining. So it's his son, not mine. Okay. Then we deal with empty nests, and then we discover that the launching years, as we often call them, we were launching the shuttle. And they come home. And we get rid of them. We're happy to be rid of them. And 2 years later, they drop out of college, flunk out of college, drink themselves into a blottoness and, you know, whatever they do, and they come home. And we have to then bring them back into the microsystem, figure out new roles. What do you do with a 21-year-old who's graduated from college and can't get a job? And can't pay the rent, can get a job flipping burgers with that. Well, you know, kid shouldn't have majored in art anyway. And so the kid is home, doesn't have the skills, can't get a job. There you are, but is now 21. And how do you establish a microsystem pattern that acknowledges the kid's adulthood and lets you also not be bothered to death by the child? My colleagues are sitting here suggesting that we ought to do something else. Okay. All right. We can do that. They'll give you a piece of paper, and you can put your name on it. And now, you thought assignment 6 was difficult to boil down into 5. Yeah, just on that piece of paper. Just on that little piece of paper, 2 sentences or 3 that capture just some of your thoughts about what happens to the family when a kid becomes an adolescent. So just 2 or 3 ideas. And when you're finished with that, make sure your name is on it and put it on the table down here, and we'll pick them up. Thank you.